So yesterday I started with 4 decays of loop quantum gravity, and we didn't go very far, but what we have seen is that, so the phase space is described in terms of the Hdkar-Barbero connection and a densitized triad, okay, which are so canonical variables here. And so the point is that the Hdkar-Barbero connection is a SU2 connection. So this means that at this stage, when we want to build the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity, it's very similar to what we have done in 3D. Okay, so let's go to the notion of kinematical Hilbert space. And we also have constraints, which are first class. Okay, plus first class constraint. I finished on the algebra of constraint yesterday, I think. So I'm not going to go through each step again, because it's very close to what we have done in 3D. So that's why it's quite nice. So again, so we choose our configuration variable to be the connection here. So we are going to choose as a function holonomies, which are going to be SU2 in SU2. Then, so this means that we are going to work on function of the group, SU2, okay, so as in 3D. And if you remember, I said when we are really talking about, so here you have holonomies and graph, okay, again, like in 3D. And so function defined on holonomy are called the cylindrical function of generalized connection. So this is just for some vocabulary. Then, so in 3D, we focus on the issue of the measure, okay, to define the inner product. So here, the measure, if we consider one edge, okay, again, is going to be the R measure, okay, for SU2. So everything is very similar. And then it's just that, so if you are interested more in the subject and you read some literature, you will see the name of the Hdkar-Lewandowski measure. And in fact, what is this measure? It's just that, so here, when we build this measure, we really looked at two functions defined on the same graph or two functions defined on the same edge, okay? So we didn't have issue. But then the idea is that we really want to, as the kinematical Hilbert space, to take inner product between function defined on any graph, okay? And so this is what is this measure doing. So in fact, it's more or less the R measure, but it's just that you have a kind of procedure to explain to deal with two different graphs, okay? So the idea is to more or less to take the union of the two graphs to define a new graph and then take the scalar product on this. Okay, so it's called the Hdkar-Lewandowski ski measure. So if you see that on some, so, and usually we denote it d mu a l, but it's really, yeah, related to the R measure. It's just that you also have a kind of procedure to deal with different graphs here, okay? And so the kinematical Hilbert space, of course, you need to, is defined as, so there is a technical point here, because you want to take the kind of Cauchy completion of the cylindrical space of cylindrical function in this measure, okay? But so really, this could be also done in the 3D case. It's just some technical details we haven't really mentioned here. And then, so once we had the inner product, the next point was to find an orthonormal basis. And again, here we are going to consider matrix element of SU2. Okay, so we are also going to work with the basis state GMN, where G is a SU2 irreducible representation of SU2, and M and N are magnetic number here. Okay, so this is very similar to what we add in 3D, and then again, so the next step is to look at the constraint. So here, the first constraint is again the Gauss constraint, and this one is exactly the same as in 3D, and the way we impose this constraint is exactly the same thing we did in 3D, meaning we are going to do some group averaging over SU2. And so then what we get here as a result, so what we call fundamental excitation of space, which are SU2 gauge invariant states, are the spin network. So again, a spin network is defined as a colored graph. So you have a graph, and on each edge, you have a label, which is SU2 irreducible representation. And on each vertices, now you have intertwiners. So when in the case of three valent vertices, it's just given by a Clebsch-Gordan, or if you prefer, a 3G symbol. Okay, but then, of course, you could have more complicated graph with some n-valent vertices, but then usually you can always decompose an intertwiner in terms of three valent intertwiner. Okay, just that it's getting a bit more complicated. And so, so if this is V, it's for each vertices, and so spin network states really form a complete basis of the Hilbert space of solution of the Gauss constraint here. So. In network states, yeah, for complete basis of the Hilbert space of solution of the Gauss constraint. Of the quantum Gauss constraint, okay, the quantum Gauss law. And usually we denote, we'd still call it kinematical, but we add that this small g to say that the Gauss constraint is satisfied. Okay, so here we talk about the holonomy, which comes from the fact we smeared the connection variable, but we also have to define the densitized triad as an operator. We also need to smear this variable. And so this is a bit different from the 3D case. So you remember in 3D, we also smear this variable on a curve. So do you have an idea what we're going to do now in 4D, or as 3 plus 1? So do you remember the motivation to smear our variable? So the motivation was really to, so here, if you look at the Poisson bracket between this variable, you get some delta function. And so the idea was to get rid of this delta function. And so, but we also want, so we want to get rid of the delta function, but we also don't want to get any integrals here when we smear the variable. So this means that a way to do this is if we have smeared the connection on a one-dimensional subspace, then this means that we want to smear the other variable on, so here the dimension of the space is 3. 3 minus 1 is a 2D, okay? So we're going to smear the densitized triad on a surface here, okay? So here the idea is that the function, we need to find function of the densitized triad smear over 2D objects, so 2D surface. And so here, this means that we want from AI, we want to form a two form. So for this, we are going to smear this combination, which is a two form. And so then the picture you have so is that now to each edge where you have a holonomy, you have a dual, since it's in 3D now, you have a dual surface, okay? And this the density tax triad is going to be, so what we are going to call our flux variable now are going to be density tax triad smeared on this to the surface. So in a similar way that in 3D we define the length operator in terms of flux variables. So here then we get the flux variables. And so in 3D we define the length operator in terms of this flux variable. So here what are we going to define? Yeah, Florian, I think you know it. Yeah, good, thanks. Okay, so now we are going to define the area operator. And the expression is exactly the same one as I gave you for the length operator. And so what is nice is that, again, the action of the area operator is diagonalized by the spin network state. Okay, so now if you consider your area operator acting on a spin network, let's call it S, okay, then you're going to get that this is an eigenvector of your operator, and you get as an eigenvalue a discrete spectrum, okay? Again, in terms of the Planck length, so now the difference is that we have this Emil Z parameter entering into the game, and then you still have the J plus 1 square root and this kind of solution. Okay, so this is if you have a single puncture, okay, so if one edge, and then you can generalize this if you have more complicated configuration with just a sum of over the puncture on your surface. Okay, so this is for the area operator. So here the result is that, again, we have a discrete spectrum. And so I'm not going to give you the formula, but we can also define the volume operator in this context. And we also find that we get a discrete spectrum. And so this means that now with these two operators, what we get a very, the property of the area and volume operator provides a very simple geometrical interpretation. So now this means that the edge, so let's go back maybe to the graph. So what is the picture we have? So if we just consider this kind of spin network, so it's just a graph. So you see that the area operator is characterized just by the spin number, okay, and which is associated to the edge of our graph. So here this means that the edge of the spin network carries the quanta of area. And you have that the intertwiner, if you compute the volume operator, you will get an answer depending on the intertwiner at a given vertex. So you also have a quantum number, which is the intertwiner here. And this is a quanta of volume here. And so really what we're going to see now, going to the next constraint, which is the vectorial constraint, is that really all the embedding or the coordinate system that we choose to draw the spin network, okay, graph, does not carry any physical information. All the information you have here about the degrees of freedom of geometry, which is so the gravitational fields, is contained in this combinatorial aspect of the graph. What is connected to what, and so what are, and it's given then by the label of this different element of your graph, okay, which are quantum label. Okay, so this is the picture that we have at this stage, but here we just consider one constraint over three, so the Gauss constraint. So let's go now to the, so until now, everything is quite similar to 3D, okay? So everything you did in 3D and the kind of calculation, so here if you really want to compute the intertwiner, it will be by, again, group averaging. So it's exactly what we did in 3D. So everything is still valid at this stage. And then now, of course, the difference is going to come from the two other constraints. So we don't have a flatness constraint now, but we need to consider the vector constraint, which is going to generate spatial diffeomorphism, and also the scalar constraint, which is the Hamiltonian constraint. So of course, you will see that I'm not going to talk so much about the Hamiltonian constraint because it's still an open problem, and that's why then we are going to go to the spin foam formalism. Okay, but it's going to be a motivation to go to the spin foam formalism. But let's just have a quick look to the. To the special diffeo. So here, what is important? Maybe I should have. Okay, so it's that when you look at a spin network, is embedded in your surface. Okay, so sometimes we also call embedded spin network. Okay, so I'll let you. In your 3D space, okay? So here, when we just finished with the Gauss constraint, we still consider our embedded spin network, but now let's look at the next step is to implement the spatial diffeo symmetry. So we have, I call it a vector constraint. So if I call, I don't know, say, or just S, we want to implement this constraint. So this is the next step in the Dirac. Program. So the method to implement this constraint is similar to the Gauss constraint, but of course here the difference is that we have non-compact orbit, whereas for the Gauss constraint we had a compact orbit. But so let's just give me, I'm going just to give you the result. The natural bases which satisfy this constraint are called S naught. So what is that? Or if you want, also called abstract spin network in opposite to embedded spin network, okay? Stay. So S naught is the equivalence class S of embedded spin network under the action of diffeo, okay? So what is the definition here is an equivalence class, and I'm going to make a small drawing. S of embedded, so embedded spin network is what you get once you have solved the Gauss constraint. State under the action of diffeo, of spatial diffeo. Diffeo, where we consider the diffeo on our spatial space. So what does it mean here? It means that here, if I'm considering two embedded spin network, S and S prime, so here I change the notation, so I should have put a big S here, which belongs to this equivalence class. This means that if it exists here, a diffeo, such that you can relate the two. And if you want kind of small drawing, so here we consider an embedded spin network. Okay. So let's consider a simple one with label, so J1 connected to J3 with on its three edges. So this is your. So now if you apply a DFAO on this, what you will get is just something very similar, just with some deformation of your length here. So here it's the graph gamma, and here it's gamma prime. And it's just that, so this is a, here you just have the relation that gamma prime can be obtained from gamma by acting with this DFAO. And here we said that the equivalent class of gamma is equal to the equivalent class of gamma prime. So,
yeah. So the diffeomorphism let sigma invariant, but in principle, it should also change sigma because the spatial diffeomorphism. So we just sketched it like this to show that it's still embedded, but it should also, like, in principle, do something with this box that we put the spin network in, right?
But what you change when you have a DFAO, it's that you're going to move around. If you have coordinates, and then with the DFAO, you also take all the information, topological information around this point with the DFAO. So here, if in this 2D surface, I don't have any coordinate represented, okay, the only points I have are these points here. It's really the only thing I'm going to move around. Okay, so what is the picture now? Okay, so this means that here, really, S naught, or if you want an abstract spin network, is really characterized by its what we call abstract graph. And this graph is only defined by agency relation between links and node, okay? And plus the coloring, of course, and what we call also the knotting and linking property. So as in knot theory here. So here it's related to not theory, if you're interested in this kind. So to be more explicit here, so we still know how many loops you have in the graph, or winds around hole if you have a hole in your manifold, for example, or how edges are going to intersect, okay? But what you don't know where the graph sits inside the manifold, its location and its metric property, so the edge length and stuff like this. Okay, so this is not, but you know all the intersection, the linking property, and the, yeah.
But this DFAO doesn't change the decoration, you say? Like it doesn't change the J's and intertwines?
No, here it just acts on the, because what does it mean? So really this means that the J are some combinatorial properties, okay, which characterize then an area or something. But here you really it's act on the mainly on the graph.
Switch the J1 and J2 some way, like twisting it around or something like this. But it cannot change the direction of the arrows, but
So then you have to specify. So here it's the same. You should also specify there are many orientation going on. Also the orientation you go around the face and stuff like this. So you should also keep in track here if you really want to have the orientation. Yeah.
Here we have, like, as our example, just a box, which is a very trivial, fundamental group and everything. So you have, like, windings around compactified edges or something. Could you see this still in the S-knots, in the abstract spin networks?
Yeah.
Because, like, how would you show this, like, in such a graph, that there is, like, actually, like, you know, a dimension of this winding around instead of...
But it's just that, so when you act with a DFAO, okay, you don't modify the topology. So you will keep the same topology. So if you have a non-trivial topology with some winding around, okay, you cannot modify, the equivalent class. So when you're going to act with a DFAO on your graph, it's not going to change, to act on this. So when you define your equivalent class, you will still keep, you will see that all the graph you are inside keep the same number of.
So in this sense, the other way around, if I say, like, these are my equivalence classes of graphs, is this then the thing that defines the topology of this manifold?
Yeah, it's related to the,
Okay.
Yeah, of course, so here, for example, So you have seen in the example, so we in 3D gravity, at some point, if you want to solve completely the theory, you have to specify what is your topology. Okay, and that's why, so in the example I've chosen the C+1 I could choose, it was the two sphere. But then if you want to do explicitly stuff, you have to specify. And for example, it would have been much more complicated if I had chosen the torus. Okay, and we have seen some global degrees of freedom entering the theory. So here it's the same. The graph you can have on are depending on the topology. Okay, so here, so a S knot define a gauge, so SU2 gauge and a DFAO invariant state, okay, of the gravitational field. So this means then we still have, of course, the Hamiltonian constraint, okay, the scalar constraint to solve. But so what is here the picture? So S knot is really something purely algebraic, okay, quantum state of the gravitational field. So it's really an algebraic object. And in each link of the graph, so here, again, can be seen as carrying a quantum of area. So here's the picture you will get if you have an S knot. So, well, I'm not sure I will be able to really, maybe let's do that. Not so close because it's difficult to represent. So let's consider. So now if you have an S knot, you just know that each link of the graph can be seen as carry an area and the knot as carrying a quanta of volume. Okay, so here you have the quanta of volume, here you have the quanta of area. And so you can see S knot as a kind of elementary quantum excitation of space and formed by some chunk of space, meaning that here you will have a kind of volume and you have another volume, and here the area, the sheet separated the two surfaces, the two volume is the area, and it's characterized by this edge here, and this volume is going to be characterized by this knot. Okay, so you can really, you have an atomic picture of space now, okay, where atom of space. But so what is really important is that, so S knot does not live on the manifold, but defines the rare itself, okay? It's really the gravitational field. So it's the same thing we were talking at the very first lecture, that now you don't have a background to define your field. Your field in itself is space-time. And here itself, this is space-time. So you cannot really talk about where that is, okay? This is your gravitational field. Okay, so this is the picture I wanted to give you of 4D loop quantum gravity. And so, of course, then the next step is the Hamiltonian constraint or the scalar constraint. And this, as I said, is still an open problem. So there are several propositions. So one proposition by Thomas Thiemann was to use a kind of master constraint. But I'm not going to talk about this approach here. And the other proposed approach was the spin foam approach, where the idea is to define the path integral for gravity. And so this was first proposed by Heisenberger and Carlo Rovelli. Spin foam. And this is what we're going to look now. Okay, any questions first on this 4D picture? So I know from Clément yesterday that from the tutorial that you had many questions, but this is really good. You also told me that you had good questions. So this means that even if you have maybe the feeling to be a bit lost, if you have good questions, this means that you are not completely lost because you are still able to have. So I hope that with also this kind of picture that we gave today, you have an idea of where we are in loop quantum gravity and what we are able to describe as a quantum state, okay? So let's go maybe to the other approach. So I don't have so much time left, so I don't really know. My plan was to give you a first picture, quick picture of what is the idea of the spin foam approach, and then try to do the 3D case. and then try to tell you what is different in 4D, but I'm not sure I will have time to do all of that. So well, let's start and I will see. Well, and anyway, I'm going to give my lecture note to Denis, and also in my lecture note I had many references, so if you're really interested in the approach, you have a lot of reading to do, so no worry. Okay, so what is the idea of the spin form is to define the path integral representation of the dynamics in LQJ. And so the spin form approach was really motivated by the fact that so everything is really quite well defined. So what is really the strong point of loop quantum gravity is that until where I gave you the result, mathematically everything is really well understood and well defined, well written, especially thanks to Thomas Stearns. So if you're really interested in the mathematical part of the theory, you have his big book to see all the details. So at this stage, everything is quite rigorous. But of course, well, the main point is missing. We don't have the dynamics of the theory. So the spin form approach was really motivated by this. But then the result we have in spin form is that the mathematical structure is not so well defined and so well understood. But we are going to go to this point. So in GR, so if you want to define a path integral in GR, it's going to be about the transition between geometries. So given an initial geometry on a 3D or two-dimensional slice of space-time, depending if you deal with 4D or 3D, then in a final one, you want to, what is the probability of a transition between these two geometries, okay? So formally, we can write something like, we want to have something between a final slice and an initial, well, more or less an initial to a final. And this can be given by this kind of integral, but this integral doesn't have any meaning here, where here we need to specify what is the measure we use, and then we look at the action of GR. So here I use the triad and the connection, so it's going to be the Palatini action, but it could be also in terms of, anyway, metric. And so the idea is now how to give a sense to this. So what is the meaning of this? So what is the idea of spin form? So spin form, as I said, was introduced by Rasenberger and Rovelli in 1997, I think. So it's still quite recent compared to some other approach. And so the idea is that here, so in spin form, if we work in the spin network basis, we expect that the scalar product, the physical scalar product between two spin network can be expressed as a sum over, so you talk about spin network histories, and a spin network history can be seen as a spin form. So a spin form, so this can be written as a, can be expressed. So what is the picture here as a sum over spin network history? And when you go to, when you look at the evolution of a spin network, what you get is a spin form. So let's, for example, represent one spin network, which is your initial spin network, and then you look at the evolution between another one. More complicated, so here you will get some, let's add, for example, some vertices here. So here what you get, so you can see that really as an evolution between the initial spin network here and the final one, okay? And what you have here is what we call a spin foam, which is a colored two complex. So what is a two complex? So the spin network, the spin foam was just a graph, and now you make this evolve, and what you get is a set of course, you still have the vertices, you still have the edges, but now you also have faces, okay? And why is it colored? It's because, so now you add also decoration, as for the spin network, to each of the edges and faces here. So the idea is that if you start with a spin network with some decoration on the edge and decoration on the vertices, the idea is that this decoration is now going, so the decoration on the vertex is going now to be the decoration of this edge for the graph, and the decoration of this edge is going to be the decoration of this face, okay? So this means that now the decoration is going to be that SU2 group, SU2 decoration, irreducible representation associated to faces. Okay, so two complex again is this set of edges, vertices, and faces with the right boundary relation. Okay, so you know that edges is going to be bounded by two vertices, etc. So associated to faces, and you will have intertwiner associated now to edges. Okay, so this is to give you what is an idea of what is a spin foam. So if now we consider a 4D space-time region with a 3D boundary sigma, that I'm going to denote sigma. So 4D space-time region. And with the 3D boundary and let's say that we know that the quantum state of geometry of the boundary is defined by a spin network, okay? So we have a spin network S which define the quantum state of geometry of your boundary, of the boundary. Then the spin foam amplitude, okay, defines the probability, the dynamical probability amplitude of that state, and encode the whole quantum gravity dynamical contact. And the standard on that, for this spin foam amplitude, so the spin foam amplitude is going to define, so let's write it explicitly since anyway I don't have too much time, that everything is clearly stated. So define the, here the dynamical probability amplitude of that state and encode quantum gravity dynamical contact. Okay. Okay, so then the standard, so it's a non-that, okay? So it's not proven that it's true, is that we write spin form amplitude with some local locality property. So what is that? In the foil, so this is the standard. On that. And the idea is to write the amplitude, so the spin foam amplitude here, from associated to this boundary spin network as a sum over the two complex, okay, that has this, the boundary of this two complex delta C is the spin network S. Okay, so two complex is just, we're here, so we have a statistical weight, which is not so here important, which only depends on your two complex, and then you sum over the different representation associated to the face and edges of your two complex, where you take a product of amplitude associated to the face. Then amplitude associated to the edges. So this is really abstract, and you need to specify which model you are looking at to specify this different number. And even for most of the models we have right now, only one number is specified, it's this one. So here, this is the amplitude of associated to any vertices of your two complex. Okay, so you have a two complex with faces, edges, and vertices. To each of these vertices, you associate an amplitude. Okay, so if I have time with the 3D case, I can show you how you compute this amplitude explicitly, at least in the 3D case. And so it is thought that all the dynamical information is really contained, encoded in this amplitude, in this vertex amplitude.
Why is that? Why are the dynamics in the vertices, not in the other objects?
So, you can... Well, first, so this is a non-that, and in fact, you can see that, so how to give you this reason without looking at a specific model is difficult, because, then if you... So the idea of, so this is what we get. But so the idea of spin foam is that, in fact, you can really start from your, from the action I wrote here, from this, and then by some regularization. So I'm going to give you what are the different steps in the regularization process. You arrive to this number, okay? To this kind of property, where here we are going to see that usually what we compute is only this number, and which appear as a dynamical, and these two numbers, in fact, are related to the measure of the mu here, the measure, okay? But I agree with you that it's not quite obvious when you see this expression. And also what I want to say is that this is just a non-that, and here some assumptions are done, in particular that this amplitude depends only on locally on the quantum number. So you see that here, amplitude associated to the face is going to depend only on the quantum number associated to its face. And here, the edge is going to depend only on the face and edge, so the face around these edges. And here, the same for the vertices. Okay, so we have a lot of assumptions. And as I told you, contrary to the loop quantum gravity, where everything is mathematically really well defined, here there are still many open questions. In particular, all these measure terms are usually not taken into account, and it seems that, in fact, they could be quite important. So let's, since I don't have so much time to go really in detail, what I just want to say is that okay, so really, if you look at the partition function of gravity, so it's exactly what I wrote here, then you can really directly, so here it's an amplitude associated to one given boundary, but so it's exactly the same expression for the, if you look at the partition function, except that you don't have this condition, but so the idea is that really this formula can be obtained from starting from this action, from this partition function here, doing some regularization. So what are the results and what are the regularization? So let's anyway start with the 3D case where we have the Panzano-Ricci model. Even if I'm not going to do all the steps, I just want to give you what are the different expressions. So the idea is really to start from the action, you know. Okay, so it's just, as I said, so it's the Palatini action. So here I'm using the trace to say that we are contracting the internal indices, but it's exactly the same one, the same expression we have seen in the lecture. Okay, and so here sometimes in the literature when you talk about spin foam, we write this triad here as B, okay, because like this it makes explicit that it's a BF theory, which is a really, it's just a kind of topological theory, but so I'm not going to use here this notation. And so the formal path integral for 3D gravity is going to be given. So integral over dE d omega of exponential e s of. Okay, so the first step here is the discretization. So the idea is to give a sense to this. So we need to regularize this object. So the first step is to discretization of our manifold. Okay, and so usually, so this is done by replacing your manifold by a simplicial manifold with a similar topology, and so in 3D, we choose to work with the triangulation. So this means that now you see that this is completely different in spirit from loop quantum gravity. Okay, this here, the discretization is really put by hand, okay? And it's as a regularization tool. Okay, so this will be the first step. Then an important notion usually is also to introduce the dual to the triangulation. But since I'm not going to do anything in detail, I don't really need to sweat, but this is again an important notion. Then of course it's going to the next step is going to be the discretization of your variables. Of the variables, and here, since again you know what are the variables quite well, here it's going to be quite similar to what we did in 3D. So the E is going to be discretized as a kind of flux variable, so it's just the E smeared over edges here of the triangulation. The connection is going to be replaced by an holonomy, and this is going to be defined on the dual edge of the triangulation. Okay, so here this can be a bit confusing because really the main object in loop quantum gravity was the spin network, and then we talk about the triangulation as the dual to the spin network, but here the starting point is the triangulation. okay? And we will see that, in fact, what we call spin network is going to be the dual of the boundary of the triangulation here, which is going to appear. So this is just some SU2 group element associated to the dual edges of the triangulation, where we have the path order exponential. So it's an SU2 group element. Here, this can be seen as a SU2 Lie algebra element. And then here, we need the curvature. So the curvature, it's what we used in, is going to be just written as a product of the holonomy as to be equal to identity. Okay, so the curvature omega is then discretized as a SU2 group element, which is given by the product of the G that has, so it's on a closed face, okay? And it's oriented usually, and then you have a sign which comes from the fact the orientation of your edge with respect to the orientation of the face, and so this is a SU2 group element. Okay, so this means that now you can rewrite your, so after, so then the next step is to rewrite the action with discrete variable. Okay, so then what you get here is really just an action in terms of the flux and the holonomy variables, which is given as a sum of the trace of and so now the discrete path integral is given. So here, all we did is a kind of regularization of the path integral. So it's given by then on the triangulation is going to be a product. So we still need to integrate over now the variable x3. So we're here, we are going to consider the Lebesgue measure for R3. Okay, we'll consider that SU2 is R3, and then we have the R measure for SU2 group element. So over SU2, we're here, we consider all dual edges of the dual triangulation, and we get the discretized action. Okay, so then, and then we know how to compute explicitly this integral. Okay, so then I'm not going to give you here the detail, but you can integrate over the x here for this, and you will get a delta over the u variable. Then again, you use the Peter-Weyl theorem to write, to decompose this delta over the group as matrix element. And then you will get some matrix element where you integrate over them. And in fact, you can see, well, here you, maybe you cannot see it, but you will again get the nice expression you like with the 3J symbol. So Clément told me that you were scared about this 3J symbol. So here you will get many 3J symbols that are going to be combined in a 6J symbol. Everything you like are again here. So it's really just, so to compute this is just about recoupling theory of SU2. Okay, so I'm not going to give you the detail because it's not really the point here. But, and you will have some detail in my note with some kind of drawing to try to explain why, how you can see that you have only three elements coming to get the 3J symbol, etc. But so what is now the Ponsonnerie J model? I can, so again, it's going to be very, it written in terms of combinatorial object, okay, the 6J symbol, but we have a complete model. So originally, historically, this model was, as the name, it is named, it was built by Ponsonnerie and Regier, but not at all for gravity. It was they were trying to find some invariant, okay? They built that, and then the motivation was to look at this, the semi-classical limit of the sigj, which is related to the radiaction, okay? So the Panzano, so now if we get, can give you the result, and then I'm just going to give you what are the difficulties in 3 in 4D. So you have some sine factor here, some dimension of state, and then you have a product over every, so since you are dealing with a triangulation, then at the end you have a tetrahedron. Okay, so here it's product over tetrahedron of 6G symbol. And yeah, we consider the normalized sigj symbol. Okay, so this is just to tell you that once again in 3D, this is more or less well understood. We can start from really the action of 3D gravity, try to introduce a discretization, and then we get this path integral, which is defined as a spin foam model. Right here. So what is associated to each vertex here is this sigj symbol, okay? And it's really here that you have the dynamics, and it's also associated in my formula to tetrahedron, because tetrahedron are dual to vertices. But so if everything is well written, you really see that it's similar to this kind of expression. So just since I don't want to let you leave without this idea of what is the main step in 4D, just in few words. So in the 4D case, so you see that here, we know how to deal with that, but it's because really this theory is a topological theory. So really the idea with 4D is to start with a formulation of 4D gravity, where we can write 4D gravity as a topological theory plus constraint. Okay? And so this is given by the Plebonsky action. So it's another formulation. So we have seen the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is written in terms of metric. Then we have seen the Palatini action, which is written in terms of the tetrad and connection. And so this is another formulation where really the idea is to write 4D gravity as a constrained topological theory. Okay, so just what is this action in few words? And then I'm going to give you is equal to the first term is going to be a BF term. Okay, so very similar to what we have in one half of, and here this is a Lagrange multiplier, this lambda ijkl, okay? And so now if you look, so this is the Plebonsky action, and it's an action for gravity. If you look at the variation of your action with respect to the Lagrange multiplier, what you get is a constraint, and what this constraint is going to tell you is that this B field has to be written as a simple B vector, plus, and it has to be written in terms of a tetrad. So in fact, if you solve this constraint, really what you get is that with the constraint, so if you look at delta S over lambda, the Lagrange multiplier, you get a constraint, which is, you get constraint, which are what we call the simply, depending on the way you write them, but they are called the simplicity constraint. And this is really the difficulty of spin foam model, is that these constraints are second class constraints, so they are not first class constraints. And so this is going to tell you that B has to be written. So you have several sectors. In fact, you don't have only the gravitational sector, but one of the sectors is going to tell you that Bij has to be written as EI EJ, and so you see that if you plug this relation with the plus into this equation, what you get is going to be just the palette injection. Okay?
No, it should be the dual of EI wedge to J, right? So otherwise.
Yeah, so it's different. Yeah, you have two different. So anyway, here, yeah, you're right, you have the. Yeah, so maybe it's the dual one I gave you. So with the epsilon, yeah, you're right. So it's going to be this one, which is going to be the solution. IK over EL. So yeah, one of the solution is there. So you also have a degenerated sector, and you have the gravitational sector. Yeah, sorry. OK, but so these are give you the simplicity constraint, which once they are applied, you go back to gravity. And so really, the idea of for the spin foam model is to start from this section, because what we know how to quantize the BF part with the topological part. So the first step here is going to discretize, as we did in 3D, the classical theory. Okay, so we first discretize the manifold, then we discretize the variable. So the classical theory by putting a cellular decomposition. Then, second step is going to quantize the topological BF part of the theory. So quantize the topological BF part. And then, just at the quantum level, impose the simplicity constraint. Constraint at the quantum level. And this is really the tricky part because, so as I said, the difficulty of the is that this constraint, this set of constraints are second class, okay? So it's not to impose them at the quantum level. Yeah, they are not really a consensus in the community or if we have or not a model. So right now, the last model, so I can give you, but it's written here for the literature in my lecture note, are going to be, so the first model was the Barenfeld model, but it seems that all the constraint was imposed strongly, which were killing all the degrees of freedom. And so the last model are the EPRL FK model. And so if you're interested, yeah, there are some references in my notes. Okay? So I think I'm going to conclude here because it's already late, but I hope you have an idea of what is a spin foam model. And thanks a lot for your attention.